Hello, everyone. Welcome. Thanks for joining us today. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to be here moderating today's webinar on looking at the HEROES Act and how Congress is attempting to regulate debt collection during the time of coronavirus. We've got the House of Representatives recently passed the HEROES Act. There's talk about more stimulus packages on the way. Certainly a lot of rhetoric about regulating and legislating debt collection or debt collection activities at the federal level. So we've got a panel of experts here with us today to help walk us through what's going on and maybe what might be on the horizon. Before I introduce the panel, let me tell you a little bit about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news site for the ARM and credit collection industry. The site publishes unique content, maintains email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, offers a number of exciting podcasts, manages a Slack channel, just launched a series of videos and webinars on demand, all for the credit collection industry. So it is free for everyone to use, so I hope everyone takes advantage of it and gets something from it every day. Let me tell you a little bit now about today's speakers. Matthew Adams is a policy analyst at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a free market think tank based in Washington, D.C. In his role, Matthew works on financial services policy and focuses specifically on consumer credit issues. Also with us today is Jenny Lee, who is a partner at Arendt Fox and defends, counsels, and advocates for the financial services industry in complex consumer-facing and other regulatory matters, with an emphasis on resolution of sensitive disputes with the government or customer litigant groups. Our other panelist is Joanne Needleman, the leader of the Consumer Financial Services Regulatory and Compliance Group at Clark Hill. She's a past president of the Board of Directors of the National Creditors Bar Association, also known as NARCA, and also served on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's Consumer Advisory Board. The format for today's webinar is going to be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions, and we'll get to them as our discussion is ongoing. To submit a question, you can put it into the Q&A module on your Zoom webinar control panel, or send it through the chat module. This event is being recorded. A recording will be made available on the webinar recordings page of AccountsRecovery.net probably by tomorrow. Finally, before we start a discussion and to make sure nobody gets in any trouble, let me read the following disclaimer. This presentation is not intended to be legal advice and may not be used as legal advice. Legal advice must be tailored to the specific circumstances of each case. Every effort has been made to ensure this information is up to date. It is not intended to be a full and exhaustive explanation of the law in any area. It should never be used to replace the advice of your own legal counsel. With that, let's launch into our discussion. Joanne, maybe you can take us, start by talking about what the HEROES Act is and what how it sort of relates to or how it covers debt collection.
Sure, Mike. Thank you so much for allowing me on this webinar. And it's nice to meet Matthew and Jenny. And I'm very pleased to join you in this. And good afternoon to everybody on the call. I always say, I hope you all are safe, healthy, and well. So we've now, I just saw something, I think it's 97 days or some awful long number that we've all been in quarantine and we've been involved in this COVID-19 crisis. Everybody remembers back on March 27th, the CARES Act was enacted, and that was a stimulus package that provided economic relief both to consumers and businesses. There were some small credit reporting and mortgage forbearance provisions in that CARES Act. Everybody will also recall that around the time of the CARES Act, there was some proposed bills that would put a moratorium on debt collection. And those bills did not make it into the CARES Act. But since that time, we have seen states put in moratoriums on debt collection, restrict debt collection. And we've also seen, you know, I call it the drumbeat of those on Congress who have called for curbs to debt collection and credit reporting. So I think that the HEROES Act, which is very similar in its intent, like the CARES Act, again, it's to provide stimulus. It's also intended to help the states who are in very significant financial trouble because of this crisis. But whenever you have these large, multi-layered bills, you're going to have little pet projects and little priorities sprinkled in them. And as we've seen, the debt collection world is been targeted in this proposal. And let's just also remember too, this has been passed in the House. This is not the law yet, but we need to keep our eye on it. As far as debt collection and credit reporting, again, there are provisions to curb certain credit reporting during the pandemic. There is a call for, and I think we really need to look at the language carefully, really a suspension, I would say, of legal debt collection, no garnishments, no repossessions, no foreclosures, things like that. But I think we, again, have to look at it carefully because there's a line in there that says by assignment. And I'm not quite sure what that necessarily means. That's a prohibited act of not being able to collect by assignment. If you read a little further, it would suggest, again, garnishment or attaching wages or assets, but I'm not quite sure. I think what's interesting about the CARES Act is it attempts in some ways to amend or modify the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act by including creditors in the definition of debt collector, so that makes it extremely broad. And that's certainly something that the FDCPA was never intended. So let's remember these are proposals. This is a bill that has just been passed by the House. We have heard Republicans are completely against this bill. There may be negotiations, but we really have to keep our eyes on this because as we've seen in the states, and we'll talk about this a lot more today, there is a drumbeat to stop debt collection, which I think is unfortunate because as we have seen in the last 2 months, the industry has been, I think, pretty successful in doing two things. One, pivoting and getting everybody at home quickly, and two, receiving more inbound calls than they have ever received before and helping consumers in ways that was never thought possible. So I think we've got to look at that and we've got to talk about that and make sure that those are the messages that are being sent out.
Excellent. Appreciate the summary. Thank you very much. Matthew, Jenny, is there anything else in the HEROES Act that struck out at you or that you found interesting, problematic, or worth mentioning, at least as we get started today?
I think Joanne did a really great overview there. And one thing I would like to add, though, is the mandatory forbearance policy that the law would create, where any consumer who thinks that they have financial hardship can go to a debt collector and ask for forbearance, and that debt collector needs to agree to that forbearance. And between that and the temporary moratorium on collections, there's also a new facility at the Federal Reserve for long-term, low-cost credit to kind of cover these debt collectors and them not being able to essentially carry out their jobs. And I think that's my biggest takeaway with this bill is you have Congress, you know, essentially saying, no, like, you're not allowed to carry out your business during this time. And I think that sets a really concerning precedent, especially in the future where, hypothetically, if President Trump loses his reelection bid, and if Senate Republicans lose the Senate, then this can be used as a blueprint come January, if coronavirus is still around then, to implement a lot of bad policies that I think haven't really been thought out too well. And the bill was introduced on a Tuesday and passed on a Friday, so it's just chock full of things. It's $3 trillion, and it's just not good.
I totally agree. I mean, I think that Joanne and Matthew did a great job discussing the legislation, and I'm in San Francisco, and here in California, there have been a lot of inquiries on creditors and banks trying to find a way to engage in lawful cannabis banking. And to Joanne's point about the multi-layered legislative proposal and people putting in various pet projects, I was pretty impressed to see that the Safe Banking Act, which involves cannabis banking, flipped into this proposal as well, kind of under the radar. And I think that from a regulatory perspective, that also presents some interesting efforts by the sponsors of that particular legislation, which would essentially allow the banks to provide banking and financial services to cannabis businesses without the sword of Damocles hanging over their head from marijuana being a controlled substance under federal law. So that's just one example that stood out that it, I think just exemplifies for us how the legislation is really a smorgasbord of multiple topical areas, which I think will make it potentially difficult for it to be passed in its current form with respect to the debt collection provisions and also these other financial reforms.
And just on the note about the Safe Banking Act, I mean, it certainly is a pet project, and it would have been nice to have that passed as a standalone bill out of both chambers. It was passed in the House last fall on a very overwhelmingly bipartisan vote, which was good to see. The bill would also extend those safe harbor protections to secondary businesses. So that could be a landscaper who's doing, you know, work on a marijuana shop, or a plumber, and, you know, in theory, a debt collector. So I think that's also important to mention.
Okay, thank you. Excellent. $3 trillion introduced on Tuesday, passed on Friday. Sounds like, you know, when they tell you not to make a grocery list or grocery shopping when you're hungry. So let's talk a little bit. We've talked about what's in it. Let's hear from each of you as to what you think, what chances that the HEROES Act has at becoming law in either the form it's in now or a different form. There has been talk that there's more, you know, Congress isn't done with addressing coronavirus through stimulus effort. So is it going to be the HEROES Act? Is it going to be something else? Let's start to dig into that. Sorry, I didn't pick somebody. Matthew, you can go first this time. Sure.
Dead on arrival. You know, and there's no questions about that. You know, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell declared that, you know, right when the bill was passed. And I think there's a lot of stuff that it was in the bill that's never going to see the light of day. However, you know, Senate GOP leadership is interested in a phase four relief bill. And I think the big thing that's going to determine what actually gets in the bill is the next 3 or 4 weeks, maybe the next month or two, and seeing how the lockdowns shape up, seeing what the impact of the CARES Act was. There's a lot of talk right now about how much money is going to go to states and municipalities. I think that's a big sticking point for Senate Republicans and Democrats right now, and they still need to kind of work that out amongst themselves. And I think it's going to be fairly narrow in its scope. And, you know, I think Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said it would only be a $1 trillion bill. So I think there's a lot of pork that's going to get cut out of it. And the other big thing, we'll probably see some new liability protections and continued funding for the Paycheck Protection Program. But in terms of any of the debt collection things, so long as, you know, Republicans are in control, I just don't see that getting through right now.
I'll just say I agree. But I think that as we talked about in the first segment, I think a lot of the HEROES Act are policy statements, pet projects. And so we cannot, our industry certainly can't take our eye off the ball that these are priorities, and whether they get passed now or, as Matthew said, that there's a change of administration, maybe in 6 months from now, these could be issues that we have to deal with. So I wouldn't be, you know, taking the position, oh, it'll never pass. It may not, maybe not today, but it definitely could be addressed in the future.
So other than sort of kind of staying on top of it, Joanne, what advice would you have for people who are watching or listening today to sort of be active in trying to prevent anything that, you know, we're seeing right now in terms of, you know, the moratoriums that are trying to be put into bills, you know, in Congress?
Well, I think that the trade associations have done a fairly good job in organizing their members. And I think that they need to continue to message and engage both in the state and federal level. Again, what we've seen in the last 2 months is really unprecedented. And the response from industry has been unprecedented. And I mean, I was talking to a colleague of mine last week. They are so busy with inbound calls, they had to hire people. That's how busy they are. If you told me this 3 months ago, pre-COVID, I would have never believed it. So there is a desire for consumers to engage, whether it be with their bank, collection agency, whomever. They are very concerned about their financial well-being. And as an industry, to point a finger and shut them down and say that you can't communicate with them, I think is a disservice to consumers. So that's what, that's the messaging that needs to be said as we go through the summer. And, you know, we don't know right now what everybody's financial circumstances will be. Right now, there's a lot of people on unemployment who are getting by. That's going to end. What jobs will come back? We have no idea. But, you know, again, I think that this industry, you know, more than others, has been really helpful and have been a huge resource for consumers. And that message has got to continue to be put out there.
I think that's a really great point, and it's consistent with what we've seen as well, because with respect to, for example, the complaints that were analyzed more recently in the wake of this pandemic by the CFPB, what we've seen and what the CFPB has confirmed is that, I mean, at a high level, I think it's safe to say that COVID-19 has created a lot of opportunities for customer service representatives and collectors to actually fill the gap and field questions that are uniquely COVID-like in flavor. So for instance, there's been an uptick in inquiries relating to prepaid cards because of the distribution of government agencies paying unemployment benefits with prepaid cards, and consumers may not be used to that and may not have ever had to be used to that as compared to, well, in the past as they must now be. And with respect to mortgage forbearance issues and student loans, disputed charges on credit cards because people are now trying to cancel the travel plans that they had made. There's a multitude of fact patterns in which this pandemic is creating hardship for consumers, where they need to have more robust communication with their servicers, collectors, first party, third party. So I think that that as this public dialogue evolves, I look forward to there being a greater opportunity for the industry to be able to demonstrate how they're actually aiding and enhancing the consumer experience, given the demand for these sorts of clarifications.
I think that's exactly right. And just to build off of that, I think from a PR perspective, I've seen a lot of things from some of the larger banks and student loan servicers and mortgage companies where they're working with consumers. You know, they're allowing them to go into forbearance. They're allowing late payments or reduced payments. And that's really great to see. One thing I think would be good, though, is if you're a small business, you're a small business debt collector, and you're working with these consumers, then, you know, talk to ACA, you know, whatever your trade association is, and, you know, start publishing these stories and putting names to faces, because there's not really a whole lot in the news. And I think if, you know, when it comes down to it, and a staffer or member of Congress is taking a meeting and, you know, they're mulling over what they're going to do to the debt collection industry in the next relief bill, you know, if you can come there with stories and say, no, we actually are working with consumers, we're not evil boogeymen, you know, we're really making a goodwill attempt, I think that'll go a really long way in kind of getting rid of some of these people who are a little too eager to be regulating this industry.
Can I just make a point? You know, sure. It's surprising to me, you know, look, we know that the debt collection industry for years, we have been regulated either be by private rights of action or other statutory requirements. We haven't had quote regulations, but the CFPB has been working for 6 years to build a debt collection rule. And we are really on the cusp of that, hopefully that rule coming out. And it's pretty disappointing for me to see Congress kind of bypass the Bureau. I mean, that's what they were there to do. And, you know, we can have a debate of whether they're doing it or not. I don't want to get into. But they did have authority to write rules, and they published an NPR, which was very comprehensive. And, you know, I think we've got to let that rule be published, you know, and help frame a debt collection process, especially post-pandemic. So, I mean, to me, that was... it's just disappointing. It makes it as if the CFPB is not even there, or they haven't done anything towards debt collection, which we all know is not the case.
It is interesting because we have seen states that have stepped in and issued their own guidance or regulations. And in some cases, like what happened in Massachusetts, it's been, you know, it's been struck down for being, you know, let's just say for sort of, you know, overreaching or going too far. So I think that's also the dynamic that you have to watch here, at least at the federal level, is, you know, sort of there's that old saying, bad facts make bad laws. So it is interesting that there does seem to be such a disconnect between, you know, Joanne, to your point, where the inbound number, the inbound call volume is up, and we've all heard that from agencies across the country. People are looking to sort of take care of them, get themselves situated, make arrangements. But here they are, states and the federal government saying, you know, all debt collection activity should be halted. You know, there's a definite disconnect there, and it sort of seems like it should be important to try and get that message out that this isn't the problem that Congress thinks it is. So I don't know who or how that message gets out, but it does seem to be something that needs to get taken care of. We have a question that came in. I'll ask it and then use it as an opportunity to remind everybody, if you have a question for our panel, type it in and we'll get it asked. Regarding the HEROES Act, it is clear that this is a wish list messaging bill. With that being said, it appears that the credit facility being offered in this bill is attempting to address constitutional issues that a debt moratorium would raise. Can you discuss the constitutional issues such a taking would cause? Does anyone want to tackle that one?
I think this gets into the Commerce Clause, and I think that's been the justification for this moratorium, is, you know, Congress does have that authority. But I think whichever way you cut it, this is a way of buying off the industry, getting them to, you know, sit and be quiet and, you know, oh, at least, you know, we're giving you money, taxpayer dollars, to pay your bills. And, you know, that's just absolutely insane. And I mean, when you look at the issues that we've had with the Paycheck Protection Program, and especially with the new unemployment benefits, you know, I have very little faith in the federal government to handle those programs properly, let alone something like this for an industry that, you know, a lot of bureaucrats really don't like. So.
Well said, thank you.
I think if I could jump in real quick. I think that one of the silver linings that I observed recently, and I checked the docket last week, relating back to what Mike mentioned. So the district court in Massachusetts ruled in favor of the ACA, which had tried to get a TRO to block the rule, which was essentially what we were talking about. It was a moratorium that would ban telephone calls or any actions by debt collection agencies. And it's interesting that the question raises the Constitution, because that was in fact the meat of the ruling. I thought it was a brilliant decision, really well reasoned by Judge Stearns up there in Massachusetts, because the court explained that it is actually a First Amendment issue. So banning debt collection agencies and telephone calls, which, you know, the businesses have deemed that the telephone is the effective method of communication, is equal to a restraint on commercial speech, which is different from non-commercial free speech. But the silver lining, I think, is that the courts still have a role in being a backstop to some of these things, because the court applied the standard, which is that if the government is going to restrict my right as, you know, like a private business, then the interest in doing it has to be substantial, and the rule that the government uses cannot be more extensive than is needed to serve the interest. And we're talking about facts on the ground and how to get helpful facts out into the public discourse. And I think that Judge Stearns did that in a way. I don't think most people read court opinions on a daily basis as part of their literature diet, but I thought it was fascinating that the judge raised so many great points about how there are already debt collection laws that protect consumers in Massachusetts. Right. So this really very large blanket ban is definitely not proportional to the government interest. It's almost like taking a chainsaw where a scalpel will do. And there was no empirical evidence that consumers are more susceptible to undue influence during a pandemic than in non-pandemic times. And also, the court said that in this day and age with caller ID and cell phones, you know, you can simply exercise your option of not answering the phone or put it in silent mode as a viable alternative So the rule, like this outright ban, which is basically a blanket suppression order restricting First Amendment free speech rights, was way too draconian and broad compared to what Attorney General Healey stated was the reasoning for that particular ban. And I think this is helpful because once you start looking at the facts on the ground about what are the consumer harms that you're trying to protect against, I think that the Massachusetts law and then also this federal proposal will be revealed to actually be far more disproportionately invasive than is necessary, even assuming it's true the interests of the government or consumer protection. I think it's really helpful that courts are still in business and still applying the Constitution. And so I thought that was an interesting development that we saw this month.
Good bedtime reading. So if restricting debt collection activity is not the answer, isn't it? I think everyone would agree it's not. What is the best way for Congress to protect consumers during this pandemic and beyond? What would you suggest Congress do instead of just saying you can't, you know, nobody can collect on any debt? Jenny, why don't you go first this time?
I mean, I even question, honestly, whether it is the role of Congress to draft new legislation as a major reaction to the pandemic, because I agree with Joanne's point that there already are agencies and regulatory processes in place to address issues in this particular industry. But if the Congress must act or address these issues, I think it should be more marginal, kind of at the fringe in terms of providing clarity about, you know, maybe particular timelines or how similar to the way that the Congress handled the Fair Credit Reporting Act amendment in the CARES Act, just clarifying how consumers and creditors and collectors should interact with one another, as opposed to making a fundamental change that's of this magnitude in response to a crisis like this.
I agree with a lot of that, and I don't really think that Congress has too much of a role here, and it really should be left to the agencies who are tasked with these things. With that being said, I think we've seen a lot of things over at the CDC and the FDA, for example, where they're taking a look at regulations that are getting in the way of us properly responding to this. And I think the CFPB should look at that too and see if there's anything under the FDCPA that, you know, is hindering these businesses and their ability to work with consumers. And over at CEI, we launched a new policy initiative called Never Needed, and we're going through a bunch of rules and regulations and looking at, you know, what's really getting in the way, what doesn't need to be there, and encouraging agencies to get rid of them or at least temporarily suspend them. So I think that'll be a good step in the right direction.
You know, I'll just add, you know, what's going to be helpful to consumers is to get them back to work. And they have money to pay their bills. We had a 3% unemployment rate before this happened. Now I think it's some awful percentage, like 20. Matthew would probably know better than me. But, so, you know, one thing I will say, I think about the HEROES Act, which I think is important, is the stimulus to the states. I mean, the states have been devastated by this. And so I think it's important to get money to the states to help re-educate and job train. I mean, there are certain industries, the hospitality industry is gone right now. And so you have a whole swath of, you know, consumer workers who, you know, they're not gonna have those jobs anymore. So they need to be retrained to do something else. And I think that's where states could play the role. I think that's certainly where Congress can play the role. But again, I think what we've seen, the one, if there's any positive light to this whole crisis, is that, you know, we have been in the consumer financial services world told that consumers are unsophisticated, excuse the expression, stupid. They're not. They have taken the initiative in this last 2 months to reach out to whoever they need to reach out because they are concerned and they understand about their financial well-being. And many of the agencies, I think, whether it be Fannie Mae Freddie Mac, CFPB, FTC have provided numerous resources to consumers. Consumers are using the internet and digital channels more than they ever have before to get the information they need. Now we need to help consumers and Americans who are unemployed and help them get back to work, especially if they're in industries that are not going to come back for a really long time.
Well said. Thank you very much. There was another bill introduced in the Senate late last week, early this week, which would protect federal stimulus funds from being garnished. Curious if you think this legislation or this proposed legislation has any shot at becoming a law, or let's spend a few minutes talking about that. Maybe Matthew, you can go first this time.
I did see there's 4 or 5 senators on that, you know, from both sides of the aisle. And it was interesting to see Sherrod Brown on there, who's usually, you know, pushing for these types of things. But I think a lot of it is going to have to develop the next few weeks and see how the CARES Act and what the impact of that was. And I think the big thing that the wage garnishment really comes down to is so many people have probably spent these stimulus checks already. So I'm not really sure what this would really do to help that. And if Congress is playing around with, you know, having other stimulus checks at a later point, then I think there's a strong possibility they'll put some restrictions in. But I don't see this getting too far, and I don't think it's necessarily needed this late in the game.
So is it more just sort of for show than for any other reason, do you think?
I think so. I think that's what it comes down to.
So then that would probably mean little chance at becoming law, or does that mean it's got more of a chance at becoming law?
You never know nowadays, I guess.
It seems for now, at least, states seem to be winding down any of the debt collection actions they took. A lot of the moratoriums have been lifted. Other states' regulations have been eased or things like that. But it still seems, obviously, as we're talking today, Congress is intent on doing something, or at least parts of Congress are intent on doing something to regulate debt collection. I guess my simple question is why? If the states, you know, were very active and now aren't, why is there still such a need? Is it Congress just sort of trying to create a problem, you know, that doesn't, you know, sort of solve a problem that doesn't exist? Or are there other things, other factors at play that we in the industry should be aware of?
I'll take a quick stab at that. I don't have an easy answer. I think if part of it is a concern when you see 20% employment, what's going to happen? You know, where are we going to be in 3 months? So maybe it's more of a preemptive type of ideal of putting these things in place. But otherwise, I'm not quite sure why the alarm is being sounded so quickly on this, because we don't know. Yes, a lot of people lost their job. There was that immediate need, but we just don't know what the recovery will look like. I mean, if we were having this conversation maybe in September, October, we still had a high unemployment rate. At that point, you know, consumers are now maybe 3 to 4 months behind in payments. You know, that then maybe it's a better conversation. But I think if you look at the data pre-COVID, while consumer unsecured credit was starting to really tick up, the rate of default was not extremely high. It's hard to align why there has been this alarmist reaction. I think it's a better conversation to have after we get through the summer and see where we are. And at that point, we can assess and see whether these moratoriums do make sense in light of where consumers are and if there's excessive debt.
And I think the states also realize that there's bigger fish to fry right now, and things have kind of subsided for at least momentarily. However, I mean, if you look back the past 3 or 4 years, there's been a lot of traction at the state level, especially on payday lending and all of these kind of like industries that, you know, aren't seen as so favorable by a lot of these people. And you have a lot of the so-called consumer groups out there going to these, you know, state legislators and saying, oh, you know, we need to do this, do that. And I think it's fallen to the wayside now, but I don't think it's going away at all. And I think it'll come back definitely come the fall. And, you know, if this continues and things get worse, then I think that's something we're going to have to face.
know, this is a thought that just popped into my head, and I may be months behind on coming up with this, and everybody else may have already realized it, but I'm wondering if, with all the forbearance plans that have been put into place for people with student loans, mortgages, and some of their other bills, do you think that's freed up money for people to actually pay some of their other debts? Are they, is that the situation? Do either any of you think that that might be the case? That's why people are being so proactive, is that, you know, they've got a little bit of a window where they've got a break on some of their bigger bills and are looking to take care of some of their old ones? Or is that not what's going on? Because it's perfectly fine if it's not what's going on. It was just an idea that popped into my head.
Possibly. I think it's potentially the case. I mean, so what we've seen is that, I think at a high level, it's all still so new that I think we're in this particular phase where everyone's just getting their bearings and trying to sort out the impact of all the changes as far as the sheltering in place, how this impacts workforce issues, family, you know, homeschooling. And so I think consumers are inundated with a lot of different choices that they never had to make before, juggling new day-to-day lives that never looked like this. And I know one data point comes from the CFPB, which is that initially there was confusion with regard to these forbearance plans that folks thought that after 3 months, there will be a lump sum due of 3 months worth of payments when that's finished. And the CFPB, in coordination with the other federal regulators, worked with the industry to clarify that, no, there will be an option to simply extend the term at the end of the mortgage or at the end of the student loan term. So I think that consumers are probably in a state of a bit of transition, chaos, trying to absorb what they're learning. I know some of these hold times are very lengthy in order to try to get a hold of their servicers or creditors. And again, that kind of goes back to our point about the role that the collections industry has in filling that gap to provide information to consumers. So I think that, you know, everybody's kind of grappling with this new state of play, and you know, everybody's trying to adjust as best they can, both from the consumer side and the industry and the regulators too, frankly.
I also think that there's probably a lot of mental math going on right now and trying to figure out, oh, if I pay this bill now, will that fit me at a later point? But I mean, you know, we've yet to see how this is going to play out. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a lot of people who are saving right now, mm-hmm. and, you know, saving that for a rainy day when, you know, this gets worse, or maybe it gets better, then you can go off and pay all those debts that were in forbearance. So I'd be curious to see kind of how that looks.
I think that's right. I think a lot of people are, you know, hoarding cash because they don't know what their jobs will be or what the outcome will be. But I think the point of this great discussion is it's different for every consumer. And to put a one-size-fits-all and say, stop debt collection, what happens if I want to pay my bills? What happens if I want to do a settlement? I mean, there has to be, especially now with the pandemic, options for consumers. That's what they're asking for when they make these calls. And to put a one size, to treat every consumer the same, to me is not necessarily consumer protection. I think we have to be sensitive to everybody's situation. Everybody's situation is going to be different. And to Jenny's point, this is a time where people are looking for, they want to hear about their options, they want to think about what's going to be best for them, and there has to be an open line of communication to do that.
To your point, there's someone who submitted a comment, loan forbearances combined with the additional unemployment funds has helped consumers. Many of our calls have been people looking to pay off their debts, and all are saying they're going to try and buy a house while rates are low. So they're looking to sort of, you know, get some of the old credit negatives, I guess, off their credit report. So let's keep talking federal, but let's transition a little bit and from Congress to talk about the CFPB. Wondering what each of you think, if regulation legislation is needed at the federal level. We talked a little bit about it, but why hasn't the CFPB been more involved, or why aren't there more calls, I guess, for the CFPB to get involved. Matthew, maybe you can kick us off.
That's a great question, and I think they're, you know, still working diligently on, you know, their debt collection rule. I think there's a lot of hesitation right now to make any moves that are going to be, you know, not fully thought out, and the CFPB is very politicized. I don't think Director Craninger wants to get too much flack right now, and I think she's played her cards right, and she's put out a lot of good educational resources, and I think that's the best thing they could do right now. I think, you know, if we don't want Congress to be acting too swiftly, you know, the CFPB shouldn't either. And if there is, you know, something they can do, then that should, you know, probably come through guidance. But, you know, any form of rulemaking, I don't think is, you know, I don't think this is a good time for that.
And I guess there has been some guidance. They did put out guidance with respect to credit reporting and how, you know, they might not, they will be a little bit more lenient, I guess, in if a furnisher needs more than 30 days to investigate a dispute. So I guess they have been involved to a degree. But, you know, sort of looking at calls for the CFPB, I'm not sure everybody noticed, but yesterday I saw that there was a report published, or a paper published in the California Law Review by a trio of law professors who call for, if not a government, you know, government mandated moratorium on debt collection, then at least a guidance from the CFPB that any debt collection activity would be equivalent to an unfair, deceptive act or practice during the pandemic. Curious what each of you might think about that and any response to what was proposed. Jenny, would you mind going first?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, I worked with Dalia Jimenez. She was an RMR. When I was at the CFPB, I was in enforcement, and we worked on a number of issues together. I read her paper, or the summary that we were sent about the paper. And I mean, I think this is a terrible position. I think this is another example of this sort of like blunt force, way too overbroad proposal to act, I suppose, to do something about debt collection, which is not necessarily tied to the data or how the industry actually works. And I think just briefly going back to the question about why has the CFPB not gotten involved, I think this is a really interesting question. There are a number of reasons for it. In my view, CFPB is a large, non-monolithic, powerful agency, and I do think that from our discussions with folks there on matters, they are working as hard and fast as possible. But in the rulemaking arena, their regulatory agendas that they have, the Bureau is not necessarily prioritizing relief to issues in the debt collection industry specific to COVID. Second, I think that as we speak, they're building out new working groups and functions to try to look for ways to address COVID-like problems. But what we've been told is that they're not going to shut down their existing operations and functions for the sake of doing so. And we've seen that borne out in the dockets and in exams and investigations, in enforcement, supervision, regulation. There are activities that are still going on right now. Third, I mean, I agree with Matthew that basically because of the transition with Director Craninger still being in a relatively new role as compared to say Director Cordray, I do think the Bureau is loath to make large commitments in certain industry areas without first gathering all the facts. And they're in the process of determining how to respond to COVID. And I think that lastly, we're told that they are already inundated with other requests for regulatory relief from other industry groups like creditors and banks, trade associations. And I know that folks there are incredibly busy, like working from home. It's across the board, mandatory 100% telework. And the director's meeting on multiple conference calls with trade associations and banks doing outreach to respond to their requests for regulatory relief. So I think in the grand mix of all these things, because it's not monolithic, multiple silos in the organization, the notion of acting with a unified voice to address debt collection concerns, policy and regulatory wise, is lost in the mix. In the enforcement realm, you know, they're still litigating the cases we've been watching involving Ocwen, Navient, Fifth Third. This new CFPB is pretty aggressive and actually suing banks in litigation, which is a new thing. So I think they're working as hard as they can, but you know, the Dodd-Frank Act built in a blueprint for the CFPB's authorities and functions that's very broad and all-encompassing, so to try to do all those things while also responding to the pandemic is a pretty pretty heavy workload.
And just going back to the paper that Mike mentioned a minute ago, I think there's a lot of research to show that, you know, any and all restrictions on debt collection, you know, ultimately result in higher prices and less access to credit, especially for those high-risk borrowers who are low income too. And Todd Zwicky, who's a professor at George Mason University, he's also leading the new CFPB task force on federal consumer financial law, had a paper in 2015, and he kind of went through all that. And that's been a good blueprint for me when, you know, trying to debunk some of these arguments, because, you know, I think time after time where states have played around with this, we've always seen negative results for consumers. And that's certainly not what we need during a pandemic.
Now, let me add one point. I don't think that this paper will necessarily persuade the CFPB to make those kind of conclusions. However, beware of what will go on in the states after this is done. There is going to be a lot of state investigations. We all know the complexities of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act and contacting people in inconvenient times. Well, is this an inconvenient time? So issues of debt collection and UDAP, I see more will be, will rear its ugly head at the state level more than it will at the federal level.
I think I also just want to jump in about that paper that from my perspective, being this sort of like nerdy lawyer that really loves the Dodd-Frank Act and analyzing elements of UDAP, I just don't understand what the legal argument would be. I mean, there's nothing deceptive. There's not a material misrep that a consumer was reasonably relying upon that, you know, would. There's not like a satisfaction of the elements of a UDAP to be able to make that equation that debt collection efforts would be a UDAP, or like for unfairness, like what is in fact the substantial risk of harm in this particular industry? The judge in Massachusetts, he said, there's no evidence that debt collectors are more likely to disobey social distancing orders and chase after consumers to collect debts than any other business that operates. So I think we have to be very rigorous as attorneys and practitioners in terms of demanding precision, that just because there is such a thing as UDAP doesn't mean that we can wash away the elements that you need to prove a violation. And I am pretty surprised, I suppose, by that paper, because I don't really see any legal rationale for how doing what they propose would actually help cabin unlawful practices, given that there's no showing of like a substantial risk of consumer harm, given that, as the speakers mentioned, there is potentially countervailing benefits to consumers from debt collection because they can get their questions answered, the products can remain lower priced. And of course, the element of, was the harm reasonably avoidable by consumers? What about consumers who have questions about their credit report impact, or they want to have this communication? So this notion that this is a harmful act that consumers, you know, we're going to question whether they could have reasonably avoided it, that framework doesn't even make sense when it's the consumer who's interested in getting the answer. So I was very surprised to see that particular proposal.
Joanne, to your point, we did a webinar yesterday talking about sort of what's going on at the state level, and there was the comment that even though, you know, for example, in Massachusetts, the regulation what was deemed to be overreaching and the restraining order was granted, that doesn't mean that the Attorney General's office isn't still going to be looking very, very, very closely at what activities debt collectors are doing in in Massachusetts in this case, and possibly, you know, to, you know, make, you know, looking to enforcement actions based on what they find. So I guess that's you know, something that everybody else needs to be aware of, is that just because the regulations got, you know, there isn't a regulation, doesn't mean that, you know, they're not looking very closely at what you're doing.
I was just gonna say, I agree with that. I mean, there's gonna be a lot of scrutiny, especially, you know, there was a very quick push and pivot, obviously, because of the crisis, for a lot of agents to be working at home, which is not permitted in many states because of licensing requirements. There's gonna be a tremendous scrutiny about how that worked out. And that, you know, if these calls for moratoriums don't work, there will, you know, other, there will be other ways in which the industry can be scrutinized. That are in place now, and that's through CIDs, and that's through supervision, and there's going to be this period from March of 2020 till whenever will be a period that will be looked at, and to make sure that the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act was followed, state law was followed, and, you know, to the extent of state UDAP, the way they want to interpret it will be looked at as well.
I saw a question pop up in the thread. Can you share, repeat the source materials to prove regulation on debt collection equals higher costs of credit? So the section would be, so because the academic paper is trying to propose that it be a federal violation, we'd have to go to Section 5 of the FTC Act for unfair deceptive practices, or Section 1031, Section 1036 of the Consumer Financial Protection Act, which is in Dodd-Frank. And it's not exactly like a regulatory requirement, like black and white, like if, you know, if it's higher cost, then it's, if you can prove that it avoids higher cost, then it's lawful. It's more of like the elements is that for something to be unfair under Section 5 or Sections 1031, 1036, it has to be proven by the government or a private litigant that that there's no countervailing benefit to consumers or competition. So in analyzing that particular prong, the argument would be that the practice of debt collection helps to lower the cost of credit or lower the cost of servicing or whatever the formula needs to be. And that is equivalent to, there's a countervailing benefit to consumers, therefore it cannot be an unfair practice under UDAP.
And then just to plug the paper I mentioned earlier, that was a 2015 paper from Todd Zwicky, who's a professor at George Mason University.
Yeah, if anybody needs the link, just reach out to me. I'm happy to provide it, because I think I've got a copy of it. Going back to the conversation we were having about the states, there was a question that came in a while ago that I've been holding off on until we got to it. But do you think states, as well as the CFPB, are sending out more CIDs during the pandemic? This particular questioner has heard that. Wondering if any of you have seen or heard that as well.
I have not seen. There were a really good amount of CIDs that were being issued prior to the pandemic. I haven't seen anything in the last 2 months. You know, just speaking from my own experience, I'm sure Jenny can add in on that. I do suspect, as we just talked about, you know, come maybe the summer or in the fall, I think certain states are going to be very active, Massachusetts being one of them, on the state level. And CFP may or may not be. I don't have the answer, but I will tell you, if there is a change in director, they will be very active.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. And I think if we can rewind a bit to before, you know, maybe 6-7 months before the pandemic, there already was an increase in activity by the states in terms of places like Massachusetts, California, New York, Illinois, Pennsylvania as well, in terms of this notion that because of the change in Trump administration view and this perception of a neutered CFPB, that now there needs to be more states stepping up to the plate and launching investigations and inquiries. And our understanding is that has still happened, although all those agency employees and lawyers are transitioning to working from home. So there might be more leniency in the timelines involved as far as the compliance dates for the CIDs, but they're still active in their investigations and their exams. And for the CFPB folks, I mean, I think that what we've seen and what we've been told is that similar, they're still doing the work of investigations, finalizing consent orders, bringing lawsuits, and there is a similarly additional leniency where, like, if a company had had HQ in a particular state that was shut down for shelter in place, maybe they'll extend the timeline for compliance by modifying the CID. But there's also been confirmations from the CFPB that the justifications have to be tailored to what's going on with the company. It can't just be, oh, the NORA letter's due in, next week, but let's put it off till July because of the pandemic. They would reject those requests. So there is still a lot of activity. And I think there is an ethos to kind of respond to the question, the last part of the question, are they trying to justify their importance and their jobs? I think there is an ethos at the Bureau and at some of these agencies of basically, you know, our mandate still exists. We're all marching forward, even despite the pandemic, and trying to get things done. And I've also heard that, similar to what I hear from clients and also see from my colleagues at other firms, is that there's just a blurring of work and life now. There's no boundaries between weekdays and weekends. So similarly, the folks running the agency exams and investigations, I think, are just grappling with always working, like working longer hours and longer days than they ever had to before because of the changed circumstances.
Good point. Well, we've just about run out of time, but I'm not letting everybody off the hook that easily. What I'd like to do is go around the panel one more time, give you a chance to share a key takeaway, a summary of what you talked about today, any other important points that you or warnings or anything else you want to sort of leave with our audience as we move forward and as this topic continues to evolve, things that they should just sort of keep at top of mind or whatever you want to discuss as part of some concluding remarks. Jenny, would you mind going first?
Sure. Very briefly, I think to the extent that the businesses are seeing any changes in the length of time that it takes to respond or any issues relating to more barriers to providing consumers with resolution, that it would be good to document, because I raised that there will be a time when regulators will potentially probe the performance of companies in this particular period. And a lot of these policy issues, while they're just debates at the moment, will crystallize into investigation bullet points or examination outlines. And so I think anything that businesses can do to document what the efforts have been to make good faith efforts to help consumers resolve confusion. I know that businesses already are doing this with robust complaint management software and tools, but it would be a good opportunity to take a moment and just ensure that from a compliance perspective and operations that businesses are taking advantage of this time to make sure that their record keeping on these issues are robust.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Matthew?
Sure. I think my three biggest takeaways would be to pay attention to the states. This issue isn't going away anytime soon. And to pay attention to November and see how the election shapes up, because that's going to have a large impact on this coming into the new year. Secondly, make sure you're sharing those stories and, you know, talking to your trade association and getting these things published. That's, I think, going to be so valuable and, you know, really go a long way and everything Jeannie mentioned there. And I guess I'll do a little plug for CEI as my third one. Go to our website, cei.org, check out Never Needed, and, you know, we're all doing a lot of work to compile some of the rules and regulations that are really, you know, messing up our recovery.
Excellent. Thank you very much. We'll definitely do that. Joanne?
Well, Matthew and Jenny have hit all my points. I would just say I really hope come the fall we have a debt collection rule. I think having a published rule will counterbalance some of these calls for a debt collection moratorium, because at least we'll have a baseline of practices that everybody on a national level should be engaged with. So I know this, people, from what Jenny tells me, everyone, the CFPB is working very hard. So continue to work hard, and hopefully we can get this rule out sooner rather than later.
That sounds great. Well, Jenny, Matthew, Joanne, thank you so much for your time today, really sharing your insights, your expertise on a topic that is very important, but always changing. So I really appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
All right, everybody. Thanks for watching. We'll be back soon with more webinars. Stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net. I hope everybody stays safe, and we'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Bye, guys.